Okay, so what's the purpose of the talk? So what I want to introduce to you is a scheme called Universal Randomization Group Machine, which we can use to solve flow equations in quantum gravity. So in terms of references, the first one is a generic review, state of the art of the field. And the scheme itself, so here it was proposed in the first reference, and the second reference has some auxiliary formulas and collected many of the useful identities that we encountered on the way of applying this. So in terms of disclaimers, I should say, this talk doesn't involve random number generators. We are not doing Monte Carlo. So our numerical approach or computational approach to making quantum gravity computable is purely combinatoric. So let's go to the outline. Will it work? No, this doesn't work. So before getting into the computational aspects of the talk, I want to give an outline what we actually want to compute. So what is our motivation and what is our goals? Then I want to introduce the central equation that we want to solve in this program. And then the main part is here in terms of the technical aspects of solving these equations. So first introducing central ideas, which you can still use by hand, and then going to computation or computer-based frameworks. So permitted time, I will also say something about the quantum structure of space-time that we get from this picture, and have a summary of what we talked about. Clearly, the most important message of the talk, feel free to interrupt. So make this interactive. This is a school. So if there are any questions about the material I present here, fire away. Being the last speaker of the talk, so let's take a starting point. Okay, of this conference, you are paying attention. That's good. So starting point, classical gravity. So we know we have a very good description of this theory. This is based on the classical Einstein-Hilbert action. So here we have curvature terms. This is scalar curvature. We included a cosmological constant. And when we test the predictions of this theory, we learn this is actually very good from submillimeter ranges up to cosmic scales. So in particular, if we do experiments on the solar system scales, then this is very well verified. So now being on a conference on quantum gravity, one can ask, okay, why can't we use this one as a starting point to build up our quantum theory of gravity? And then one can investigate the structure of this equation, and what one learns is that it has a particular feature that makes it very different from the other forces of nature. And this is hidden here in the coupling constant G Newton. So if you make a dimensional analysis of this equation, it turns out that this coupling constant has a negative mass dimension. Okay, fine. Then you can start applying perturbative quantization methods to this. And then you will encounter the following. So compute an L-loop diagram. It will diverge as the energy squared of your diagram times a dimensionless combination. So in our case, in four dimensions, this dimensionless combination is the coupling constant times energy squared to the number of loops that you have in the diagram. So this has the problem, the number of divergences grow with the number of loops that you have into the game. So that means at every loop order, you need to introduce new counter terms with more derivatives to actually absorb these divergences. So if you do this analysis and try to search for these counter terms, then you have first a one loop counter term. So this goes like curvature to the second power. Essentially, you have four derivatives sitting in here. But it turns out in terms of pure gravity, this guy is not really present. It's an on-shell term, so this is not really a problem unless you add matter. If you go to the pure gravity case, then you see you have to do a two-loop computation. Then you find this counterterm, famously called the Gorov and Zagnotti counterterm. So it involves six derivatives or three powers of the Weyl tensor. The problem is that these guys are actually not of the form of your initial action that you have up here. So you cannot absorb these divergences in a redefinition of Newton's constant that you do in standard perturbative quantization. As an upshot of this, we see that general relativity as a starting point is perturbatively non-randomizable. Okay, this would be a bad place to end this talk, so there must be a loophole. Okay, the loophole of the conference, quantum gravity may be non-perturbative. So following up in the spirit of the other talks that we have seen, what we want to do is a statement of intent. We want to make sense of the path integral over gravitational degrees of freedom. So schematically, we can write this as an integration over our gravitational degrees of freedom weighted by some action. Throughout the talk, I will work with Euclidean signature. So no phases to be considered here, and I have a minus sign. Now, if you survey what has been presented in the talk, then in the talks of this conference, then already at the statement, what are the gravitational degrees of freedom, we have seen a lot of variety. So in this talk, we take the gravitational degrees of freedom to be fluctuations of the space-time metric. That brings us to the road of asymptotic safety. We also saw other proposals. So we saw spins living on a topological structure. This went into the spin form programs, tensors carrying group indices, group field theory, or pre-geometric structure as encountered in causal set theory. So first challenge is, let's decide what these gravitational degrees of freedom are. Conceptual challenge two, what should be the action that we put in here? So it's expected that you cannot put there anything you want to do. So presumably there should be a certain subset of actions for which this makes sense. Thirdly, so here we are only talking about gravitational matters, degrees of freedom. Clearly, our universe is not empty. So if we want to have a realistic description of our universe, we also should include matter fields in our description. So that's as an outline. What about technical challenges, since this is the core of the conference? So once we have made sense out of this, what we want to do is we want to compute observables, which characterize our quantum spacetime. And we want to see that this formulation actually connects to classical general relativity. Then we learned that we have a well-stocked toolbox in order to analyze the structure of these equations. So we prominently discussed Monte Carlo methods in the first few days. So Timothy Butt, Lisa Glaser gave very good talks on this. We had randomization group techniques, if the degrees of freedom here are spins sitting on a spin form, and we heard about holographic methods. So to place this talk in the context, so what I want to do is I want to add a new element to this toolbox, namely functional randomization group methods. So how should this work? So let's first start with outlining the arena where the functional randomization group takes place. So first, we take a rather abstract notion of a theory. So for us, the theory is specified by a field content. In our case, this could be a graviton or metric fluctuations. We specify the symmetries that we want to place into the problem. In our case, this should be diffeomorphism invariance. And it turns out, what is also important, to make a statement about the admissible fluctuations. So essentially, this relates to the measure that you put into your path integral. So we have seen prominent examples for this. So fluctuations preserving the signature of your space-time metric or the topology, so disappeared when we discussed Monte Carlo simulations. Okay, given that we have this input, we can construct actions. So specifically, an action will be a combination of interaction monomials. So we take our field content and we build up terms like this. Restriction, they should be compatible with the symmetries that we have in our problem. So typical example here is the Einstein-Hilbert term. Then we can take all the actions that we can construct this way and bunch them together in one large space. So this brings us to the structure of theory space. So this contains all possible action functionals. Then we can introduce coordinates on this space. So these are typically the coupling constants describing our actions. So here we have the small gi's. Small gi's will always be dimensionless in the talk. We have encountered dimension-full quantities on the way already. So typical candidates are Newton's constant, cosmological constant, and probably many more. Then it turns out that this space actually carries a structure, namely the randomization group flow. So this flow relates the same physical theory at different scales. And for at the level of the coupling constants, we will see that this connection is actually made by the beta functions, which actually govern the energy dependence of our couplings. Okay, this is the framework. Here is the nice cartoon version of it. So we have one big space, the theory space, the action functional span this space. We have a vector field living on this space, which is our RG flow. And in the end, we are interested in RG trajectories, which describe the same physics. So ideally, for complete theory, these RG trajectories should be complete in the sense that they describe microscopic physics and macroscopic physics and can interpolate between the two. So then, how do we get to the point that we can take the limit of small scales in a controllable way? Then it turned out the ingredient that we need are fixed points of the randomization group flow. So if we talk about randomization of a theory, then the underlying structure is precisely such a fixed point. We have the definition of this fixed point. So here, by definition, all our beta functions vanish simultaneously. So as a result, we can spend an infinite amount of RG time close to the fixed point or at the fixed point. Now, what's the good of having such a fixed point? So clearly, we can illustrate this by looking back to the example where we had the problem with the divergences of L-loop diagrams. So suppose you have a fixed point where the dimensionless Newton's coupling constant goes to a constant. Then let's reinvestigate the divergence of our loop diagrams. We saw that the divergence structure is precisely governed by this dimensionless combination. So for constant Newton's constant, dimensionful Newton's constant is divergent. But now if the dimensionless combination goes against the constant, we see we get rid of an infinite amount of divergences. So in this sense, a fixed point can cure precisely the problem that we have in this perturbative expansion at high energies. Okay, given that such a fixed point exists, can we use it to make predictions? And here, one has to appreciate that a fixed point comes with a structure. So there will be RG trajectories that go into the fixed point at high energies. And some of them will just be driven away if you go to high energies. So one has to distinguish between the two classes. And what we are interested in are solutions of our flow equations which actually approach the fixed point at high energies. So these are precisely the solutions that will solve the problem up here, while we don't care about the rest. So then we can divide the flow close to the fixed point in two parts. So relevant part, these are the trajectories that end up at the fixed point at high energies, and an irrelevant part, which are repelled. Now, in order to be predictive from the construction, so somehow we have to place our theory within this UV critical surface. So given that this UV surface is finite dimensional, we can do this with a finite number of experiments. So there are certain free parameters involved in this, and there's no way to get them from the theoretical side except for going out and ask nature what these parameters are. But once we have fixed these free parameters, we precisely know the RG trajectory that we have up here, and we can make an infinite number of predictions based on this. So basically all the irrelevant couplings follow as a prediction of these free parameters. So in this sense, the framework will be predictive. So now relate this to gravity. What are the potential fixed points that we can use? We can try to use the free fixed field fixed point. This is what people do use in QCD, but then we run into the problem that we had on slide one. So perturbative quantization doesn't work. So this is not a good UV completion. Then there can be the possibility of having an interacting fixed point. So for gravity, the existence of such a fixed point can be shown rigorously in 2 plus epsilon dimensions. And then we would like to see that this fixed point persists in 4 dimensions. So we can UV complete such a fixed point based gravity based on such a fixed point.
Frank, yeah. Ask a conceptual question here.
Sure.
So I can see that conceptually, if you flow to the IR,
yes.
If you want to describe constant physics, you want to know whether if there is a if there are two different theories describing the same physics, mm-hmm. that they should be uniquely defined, because the physics of scale
yes.
is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
But going in the other direction, a priori, I don't see a reason why there could be multiple theories that describe the same physics above a certain scale. Is it a priori clear why one could always go towards the UV in a unique fashion?
At the technical level, yes, so we get a bunch of differential equations. We can solve them in both directions, and a local uniqueness theorems guarantee you that the solutions do not cross. But in terms of going to a broader theoretical framework, it's clear that you could approach the same IR physics from different UV physics if you have an attractor governing your IR physics, so that differences are washed out. It will be hard to distinguish. So there are some situations where you might lose the information. More questions? No, then. Okay, this is the wish list that we want to have. So UV completion by non-Gaussian fixed point, predictive power by a finite dimensional UV critical surface, a connection to observable low energy physics, so either tested in terms of general relativity or by putting in meta degrees of freedom. For example, you want to recover the standard model of particle physics at a scale of 1 TeV, since this is something that has been extremely well tested. And then there is a list of structural demands. So in the end, you also want to be able to say something about black hole dynamics, resolution of singularities, resolution of lambda poles in the meta sector, and so on. So in terms of computational methods, what are the challenges? So first thing is show that such a fixed point exists and show that it is predictive. So in this case, you do quantum field theory in a non-perturbative regime. So technically what you need to construct is approximate solutions of functional randomization group equations. And be as broad as possible. Then you want to understand what is the structure of such a fixed point. So in this case, you have to solve either ordinary linear differential equations or partial differential equations. So this carries the structural information that you want to see here. And lastly, you want to integrate the equations that you have obtained up here. So again, you need numerical algorithms to construct solutions of differential equations over many orders of magnitude. So if you look at the distance between the Planck scale and the TV scale, you need to extrapolate physics about 16 orders of magnitude. So we have already seen the previous talks have focused on these points, solving PDEs. I will not have anything to add here, so I will focus on the point that I have up here, solving functional randomization group equations. So let's get our hands dirty and look at the equation that we actually want to solve. So get a feeling what goes in there. So functional randomization group equations come in a variety of incarnations. So there's an entire family of it: Kellen-Szymanczyk, Wegener-Houghton, Jaspolczynski's equation, and we will focus on the youngest sibling in this family, the so-called Wetterich equation. So quantum gravity is only one particular set where this equation is applicable. So you can also do scalar field theory, QCD, or condensed matter systems. So it's a universal set of vehicles that we have up here that applies universally to physics. Okay, we focus on the version of this equation adapted to gravity. So this is almost 20 years old. It was developed by Martin Reuter based on work that were inspired by QCD and Young-Mills theory. The general equations, idea of the equations is that instead of doing the path integral in one stroke, we do it in a piecemeal fashion. So what we do is we take our fluctuations, we impose an ordering principle on them. So order them by short-range fluctuations and long-range fluctuations, and then integrate out these fluctuations piece by piece, starting from the high momentum modes, going to the low momentum modes. So ideally, once you have integrated out all fluctuations, then this technique should arrive at the standard effective action. So now how do we get to the flow equations that controls integrating out these fluctuations? So since this is school, let's place one slide on recapping how we construct the standard effective action. So let's start from a scalar field theory. Let's write down an action containing a kinetic term, a mass term, plus potential interactions. We can put this into a path integral, introduce a source, take the logarithm of it, and we get a generating functional for connected Green's functions. Then we can take the derivative of this functional with respect to the source. We get the expectation value of our quantum field chi. So expectation value phi. Then we can perform a Legendre transform with respect of this functional with respect to the classical field. And this gives us the effective action. The nice property of this guy is, once we extract the vertices of this guy, they include all the quantum corrections of our quantum field theory. So now all the loop computations have been done up here. So all the quantum information is included in here. The problem here is doing precisely this, namely doing the path integral. So here, the proposed strategy of doing this path integral is we introduce a scale-dependent mass term for our scalar field. So this is the modification. It introduces a scale k, which separates our high momentum and the low momentum modes. So essentially, in the scalar case, this is a momentum-dependent mass term here. So it's quadratic in our fluctuation fields, and the mass is chosen such that this term vanishes if the fluctuations have momentum much larger than our cutoff scale, and it suppresses the low-energy fluctuations. So high-energy fluctuations are integrated out unsuppressed. Low-energy fluctuations are suppressed by this guy. And if we lower k squared, then we unsuppress fluctuations and integrate them out shell by shell. So this precisely realizes the idea that we had before. Now we can perform all the steps that we had before. Start from the generating function, which now depends on the sliding scale k. Do the Legendre transform, add this extra term, and then you see, by some formal manipulations, you can cast the scale dependence of this quantity into a formally exact equation. So the left-hand side tells you how this quantity changes with scale, and the right-hand side sees, actually drives the scale. So what we have up here is the second variation of our gamma with respect to the fluctuation fields, and there's the regulator appearing here. So you can read this equation as an improved one-loop equation. So the appearance of exact propagators here makes this a formally exact equation. The interplay of the regulators down here and in the numerator ensure that the right-hand side actually localizes in momentum space. So essentially you only get contributions where k is approximately from fluctuations with momenta closer than k. Again, if we put the right boundary conditions on this rk so that it vanishes for k equals to 0, then this gamma k agrees with the standard effective action as we are in the infrared. Important, we don't need to specify a fundamental action before running this thing, so we can use this to actually search for the actions that make our path integral well defined. Questions to this point? If not, that means I've either lost the audience or everything is clear. Okay. Let's take it up one step. We did scalar field theory. What changes if we go from scalar field theory to gravity? Now the starting point, instead of a scalar action, we now take an action constructed from our metric. This action should obey diffeomorphism invariance, and here this is the point where the complications set in. So instead of scalar field theory, we now deal with a gauge theory. So what we have to do is we have to restrict ourselves to physically inequivalent configurations. So somehow we have to mod out the diffeomorphism symmetry. Typically this is done via the background field method. So we take our metric and we split it into a background metric plus a fluctuation field. So here I did a linear split, but other implementations are possible. So it turns out what you put in here is actually crucial information on the path integral measure. It's subtly hidden in this equation, and we can discuss this during the break. But for the time being, let's focus on this linear split. Then we add a gauge fixing term and a corresponding ghost term. And if we do this appropriately, we get an auxiliary symmetry, which will lead to a diffeomorphism invariant effective action once you are at k equals to 0. The flow equation is precisely in the same form as we had in the scalar case. The only exception is that now it depends on more fields. So we have this background metric G bar sitting around. We get ghost fields exponentiating the Fadev Popov action, and we have fluctuation fields H sitting around. Otherwise, the functional form stays precisely the same. It's only more fields that we have to deal with. Yes?
In all the analysis so far, the fact that you're using a Euclidean action is that important? I mean, could you not have just taken the Euclidean framework? Where is the, couldn't you just start off with the Lorentzian framework?
Up to here, it's completely unimportant. The importance comes in the next step if you want to evaluate the right-hand side of this equation. So as soon as you change from Euclidean to Lorentzian, you lose a lot of mathematics that is quite useful for doing so.
But there is no replacement mathematics that can... I mean, what I'm saying is that there's some instabilities or something that happen, or in the Fermi equations, or...
No. The problem is that in Euclidean, your operators that appear here, you will see that they are bounded. So this is nice. If you go to Lorentzian, they are unbounded. And then essentially it becomes tricky.
But there's no conceptual problem.
There's no conceptual problem. So this is the equation that we want to study at this point. So, first, conceptually, it's very hard to solve this exactly, if not impossible. So we have to come up with approximations to this equation, and we have to come up with approximations that do not rely on the expansion in a small parameter. So the tool of choice is to restrict this functional form of this effective average action gamma k. So we have interaction monomials constructed from our field content. They are multiplied by our coordinates on field space. They will be promoted to scale dependent, and we can restrict to a finite or infinite subset of all the interaction monomials that are there. Once we have such an ansatz, we can substitute it into our flow equation, project the left-hand and right-hand side on the set of monomials, and then we can read off the flow of these coupling constants based by matching coefficients on the left and the right-hand side. So that's the strategy to get our set of beta functions for the couplings. Then on the technical level, so we have the type of couplings here that are included here should be distinguished in two cases. So technically, they are single metric computations which don't disregard the fluctuation field H. So everything is evaluated at the background level, setting H to zero. But then it was predominantly the Heidelberg group which also set up a similar formalism which is based on keeping non-trivial powers of the fluctuation field around. For the purpose of the talk, I will focus on this first part. So, how to do these computations in practice? First, we need a basis for our interaction monomials. So, luckily, mathematicians have solved this classification problem. So, we can use the Fulling, King, Weilburn, Cumming basis. So, essentially, this tells you it's all the contractions of the Riemann tensor plus derivatives of the Riemann tensor that you can write down. Now you see from this slide, this quickly gets involved. So the number of basis elements increases rapidly as you increase the number of derivatives that you allow to construct your monomials. So at the level of the Einstein-Hilbert action, the choice of monomials is actually unique. Then at four derivative level without boundary, you have four. At the level of six derivatives couplings, there are 10. Notably, that only works in four dimensions. In general dimensions, this is more than that. And you quickly go up in numbers. But in principle, we know the interaction monomials that span our space. Now, Einstein-Hilbert action is a... Yes?
Yeah, you said that you can have an infinite sum of monomials, right?
Yes.
So this means that you can also have actions which in principle have an infinite like that are non-local, because, for example, you can express, I think you know what I mean. Like,
yes.
For example, R, 1 over box R,
you can
expand that as an infinite sum, which is included in your model, right?
Yes. So in principle, if I have this, this R, box R, is an onset of an entire family of terms which are of the form R, F of operator acting on R. So then you go at the level of structure functions, but we have not made much progress in this direction, I have to say. I will make appropriate remarks at the right places. But yes, in principle, this is a computational challenge. Einstein-Hilbert action as an example. So let's go to the algorithm of constructing a solution to this equation, approximately. So in terms of learning goals, at the end of the section, you should be able to construct the flow of Newton's coupling and the cosmological constants based on this simple ansatz for your gamma k. Our university likes formulating these precise learning goals that you know what should be the end of the story. So here's the algorithm to do so. So we have an ansatz for our effective average action. You want to expand this in fluctuation fields. And you see on the right-hand side, we have the second derivative of this ansatz with respect to the fluctuation. So we have to go to second order. Typically, what you encounter is a complicated operator structure. So you want to simplify this, to bring this back to a form that can be addressed with results that are in the literature. So once you completed the simplifying procedure, you see you need to invert this differential operator. Next step, you want to evaluate the right-hand side, keeping all the important terms for reading of the flow on the left-hand side. So in this case, you have to keep track of the volume term and the scalar curvature term on both sides. And then you compare the coefficients that appear on both sides. So that's the scheme. Let's put it into motion. So expand gamma to second order. So we set in notation, put all the background fields with a bar on top, fluctuations collectively denoted by h. Now start from gamma k, look for the term that is quadratic in the h's, and you see that there is an operator appearing which is actually matrix valued in field space. So fluctuation fields, operator fluctuation fields, it's convenient to put a factor of 1/2 in there. So what we get in this process is an operator-valued matrix in field space. This sounds very abstract. Let's do an example. Let's look for a free massive scalar field in curved spacetime. Let's keep the spacetime fixed. The action that we are looking for has this form. So here we have 2 powers of the scalar field. Here is our operator, so it's minus d squared plus the mass term. Compare it to the formula up here. You read off what your gamma 2 is. It's precisely the quantity in the straight bracket. So in this case, you see the gamma 2 is a Laplace-type operator with this mass term involved. So we can extract these operators. If the action becomes complicated, move to exact. So this is extremely powerful in order to do these expansions. Now, think about the general structure of the matrix that you have extracted. So in our simple case, we saw it only involved kinetic terms. So everything was of Laplace type. But as soon as you move to gravity, then you encounter more structures, so there can be uncontracted derivatives or potential valued terms, which involve background curvature and covariant derivatives. So typically examples, this is something that is not of Laplace form, this is an operator not of Laplace form, And these are typical examples for these type of potential terms, which involve scalar curvature or other derivatives of the background field. In terms of technical implementations, the M terms are easy. The D terms will give you a headache. So you want to get rid of them. So what are the options that we have here? So there are three options. So we can go for a clever choice of gauge fixing. So for example, if you do the computation for gravity, you encounter that alpha is actually a gauge parameter. So by setting the gauge parameter to 1, you get rid of these unwanted terms, and you are back to the simple structure. Work on a specific background. So this can also eliminate such type of D terms, or decompose your fluctuation fields in such a way that no derivative can end on them. So that is also an option of getting rid of these Ds. Example will follow. So then we need to invert this matrix. So first include the regulator term. Then you get a structure like this. So the P's are the regulated propagators. You have the potential terms M. And in order to keep track of appropriate curvatures on the left and the right-hand side, you can expand an M. So this can be done exactly to general order. So what you get is a power series expansion. So here you have the kinetic terms. Then you have kinetic terms sandwiching a potential, and so on and so forth. And you can do this expansion to the powers that is necessary. So it will always terminate at finite order. Then you still want to take care of the operators that are sitting in the trace here. So upon implementing the step, the structure that you encounter is an operator-valued function. You want to take the trace of this function. So step one, get rid of the functional form, bring this into canonical form. So take a Laplace transform to write this as the exponential of an operator. Then these traces are well studied in the literature. So here we can apply a heat kernel expansion. So this orders the right-hand side in powers of derivatives. And this is precisely the structure that we want in order to keep track of derivatives on the right-hand side. So the curvature terms that we need to match the left and the right-hand side actually appear as the coefficients in this expansion. So if you look at the first coefficient, so this trace A0, this is a 1. The trace A2 contains one power of the scalar curvature, and if you go to A4, these are terms which are quadratic in the curvature. So if you want to keep track of Einstein-Hilbert, you only need the first two terms, and you disregard all the rest that appears in the series.
Question?
Yes?
Is this where you make, is this where the Riemannian nature of the metric matters?
Yes. Yes. So if you want to Lorentzian signature, then you can, you get rid of the Laplace transform, you replace it by a Fourier transform, and then you have momentum space methods, but essentially this restricts you to using a flat space background. So then there are
So why is that?
Why you want to use this in a flat?
I'm saying, why does it restrict you to a flat space time when you're in Lorentzian?
Sorry. No, maybe this is too harsh. I think you can do more than just flat background, but I think the integrals will soon get very ugly. So you have to take care about pole structures, integration contours, and you have to do this in a curved background. Okay, we have this result. We substitute up here. Then we want to bring back the functional form of this W. So we can undo the Laplace transform here. Then you see the coefficients that appear in this expansion are actually Mellin transforms of your function W that you started out with. So you never need to compute this Laplace transform explicitly. So you can, if you know the explicit form of the function W, then this is good enough. Yes? Let me do the example and then do the break. So let's put this into motion. Let's compute an example. We want to take the flow equation that we have up here. Say we are interested in the running of the Newton's coupling at the cosmological constant that is induced by integrating out a scalar field in a curved background. So this scalar field is minimally coupled. We are not interested in metric fluctuations at this at the field. We want to understand how these coupling constants change with scale if we do this integration out procedure of this scalar field. Okay, we introduce our regulating prescription. So we dress up the kinetic term by the scale-dependent mass term. Now, we have an explicit form of our function W of the Laplacian. So it contains the regulator. It contains precisely this gamma 2 plus RK. This is in the denominator. We have the master formula that we derived before. We are only interested in the first two terms. So this takes care about the curvature terms. Finally, we need to evaluate precisely what are the Q functionals. So for that, in order to do so, we have to specify our regulating function. Convenient choice is given here. So this is a step function behavior, which essentially vanishes if the eigenvalue of our operator is larger than k square. So in this case, we can do the corresponding integral that we had on the previous slide analytically, and it converges. So essentially, this choice cuts off the integral at k squared. It also removes the z dependence from pk. So you quickly can do this integral. It just gives you a power of k plus the numerator 1 plus the mass divided by k squared plus a numerical coefficient. So now you have this formula, you plug it in here, then you have evaluated the right-hand side of your flow equation, you match your right-hand side to the left-hand side, and here is the flow that you get for Newton's constant. So cosmological constant divided by Newton's constant is encoded in the volume term. You get this result. For the cosmological constant, you re-compare the coefficient of the R square, R term. So equating these coefficients gives you this equation. So we can do these computations, at least for this case. So let's move to more complicated things after the break. 10 minutes.